Hello, this is Tevi Troy, and welcome to New Books in Public Policy. Each time we look at a new book in public policy and talk to the author to see what he can tell us from behind the scenes in the public policy arena. This week, we're going to be talking to New Republic senior editor Noam Scheiber about his book, The Escape Artists, about the inner workings of the Obama White House and its economic team. He has all kinds of hair-raising stories in there about dysfunction among the different economic aides. And we're going to talk to Noam about how he came up with all the information that he found and what it says about economic policy at the highest levels in the American government. Noam Scheiber, welcome to New Books in Public Policy.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you as well. First question, as I always ask, is who are you and how did you come to write this interesting book?
Well, I'm a senior editor at the New Republic, left of center political magazine here in Washington. That basically makes me a staff writer. I came to write the book after having covered the Obama campaign, really the presidential campaign in 2008. I started covering it back in the summer of 2007. So it was a long haul. And by September of 2008, when the financial crisis hit, I was already sort of starting to think about what I might do after the campaign. I was having discussions with my editor, then Frank Foer, and I was thinking that I might like to do something other than kind of pure politics or pure kind of inside baseball political coverage. At that point, the financial crisis hit. It became very clear that the economy and the financial system were going to be the big story of the next few years, regardless of who won the election. And so it was a nice way to have a little bit of continuity, to be able to cover some of the same people, the candidate who would become president in particular, but also shift gears and cover, less kind of overtly political topic and more a more substantive topic. It also fit a bit with my background. I had a master's degree in economics. So things seem to line up pretty well, both in terms of my, I guess, my qualifications, my interests, and the kind of the storyline that the world was suddenly interested in.
Yeah, I think the world is quite interested, and you could tell that by that. You know, Ron Suskin also wrote a book on a similar topic. And the one thing that really struck me in reading both your book and his book is that this notion that the world, meaning the financial world, both Wall Street and Washington, seem to be run by tennis-playing Jews. Summers, yeah. and Gene Sperling and Alan Krueger, and they all play tennis together, and they go back and forth between Washington and Wall Street. Do you have that sense as well? And what does that say about our financial system and our Washington system?
Yes, it's funny. I actually wrote a piece for the New Republic about the tennis playing among our senior economic officials, Larry Summers, Gene Sperling, as you say, but also Tim Geithner is part of this group. They attend, a lot of these guys attend tennis camp in St. Petersburg, Florida, every year for a couple of days. The Nick Bollettieri Tennis Academy, the famous Andre Agassi trainer. Look, it is clearly a rarefied universe, a small group of people who know one another. I think it's more insular sort of on the policy side than on the Wall Street side, by which I mean there was a small number of people, most of whom had worked for Bill Clinton, who had experience fighting financial crises. Then it was sort of overseas crises in the 90s, Asia, Russia, eventually Brazil, Argentina, a little later on. And when Barack Obama took over as president-elect first and then as president, he decided that he wanted people who had, direct experience in dealing with these crises. And that just turned out to include a pretty narrow universe of people. So I think, it clearly is insular. These guys knew each other, worked closely with one another. And I think you can sort of fault them for a bit of a lack of imagination. On the other hand, the way I sort of tell it in my book is Obama had been running, since early 2007 when the crisis hit. He had been running on these big kind of ambitious proposals, healthcare, cap and trade proposals, to deal with climate change. And while he took the financial crisis seriously, he didn't want it to be, the be all and end all of his presidency. So he turned to these people who had experience so that the crisis wouldn't entirely consume, you know, every bit of bandwidth that he had as president. So I fault them for thinking a little bit narrowly about personnel. But I sort of understand, why he was inclined in that direction as well.
Yeah, one point I think that should be made, though, is it was a somewhat controversial decision. I mean, these were seen as Clinton people, old guard people, and Obama was trying to bring in a new group of people. So it wasn't obvious that these would be the guys, right?
Not at all. I mean, it certainly wasn't obvious. And he had run, you know, of course, as an outsider, as a kind of insurgent candidate. I think the important thing to understand about Obama is how he actually, despite all the insurgency rhetoric and despite all the packaging as an outsider, he really does have a kind of establishmentarian sensibility. This dates back to his Harvard Law School days. I mean, you know, he became the president of their law review. When he first ran for Senate in 2003, I talk about this in the book, for U.S. Senate from Illinois, he called up Harvard, the Harvard Economics Department, in search of an economic advisor. And the response he got was essentially, you know, people at the Harvard Economics Department don't really advise, you know, obscure Midwestern state senators on their Senate campaigns.
I love that story in the book, by the way.
Yeah, that was really his first impulse. And then, you know, this runs through his presidential campaign. I mean, one of the names that they had bandied about internally to advise them for the presidential campaign was Alan Blinder, who had been the head of Bill Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors. He had been a vice chairman of the Fed, you know, one of the brand names in all of economic wonkery. And that was, you know, one of the people that they wanted to court for this job. And it was only when they were basically told, look, a Blinder-like figure isn't going to go work for you. Hillary is really the person that any establishment figure is going to go work for. Then he turned to Austin Goolsbee, who he's known from his Senate campaign. And even, you know, even when things went further, I mean, I did a story in 2008, by which point Obama was really starting to get some traction. And the people he was bringing in were told, you know, one of them recounted to me, were told by his aides, you know, make very, very clear that you're an expert on the subject, that you're sort of the brand name on this subject. Because he wants to know that when he talks to policy people. So the guy has a real establishmentarian sensibility. Despite the packaging as an outsider, it doesn't shock me that he would turn to these people when he, you know, basically got his pick of the litter.
Yeah, you know, I think people who staff the White House Office of Personnel in the future should look at this book, because there's risks to the strategy that you lay out, where people who have been there before are can be problematic because they bring some tensions with them and pre-existing hatreds or rivalries. But also bring somebody totally new is a problem, too. You talk about Christina Romer and how she was completely out of her depth at the beginning. She didn't understand the most basic acronyms that we in Washington kind of understand as the part of the regular alphabet soup here. And one thing you said that really struck me is that she didn't understand the verbal cues of how to work in Washington meetings. Can you talk a little bit about her and her adjustment?
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, I tell this story in the book where the president asked her a question about unemployment, asked her basically for a, you know, not the top line number, but a little more sophisticated number. And she gives it to him off the top of his head, off the top of her head, not realizing that the then president-elect is going to step out into a room full of reporters and then parrot that numbers that she's just given him. So she hadn't even checked this number. And as she sees him walk out and talk to these reporters, she's absolutely sort of panic struck. And, you know, is like scrambling to check to see if she give him the right number. So, yeah,
she was right. She was correct.
She turned out to be right. But, you sort of want to be sure before you check it when the president's going to go tell the world, you know, that this is the case. Everything from things like that to, you know, I tell another story about how, you know, during the transition, there were multiple meetings, you know, some of them happening at the same time on any conceivable subject matter. And Christina Romer sort of was the only one who sort of, you know, only one of these principals who believed she had to attend every single one of them, you know, so she's absolutely running herself ragged. And so Peter Orszag, her colleague, who is going to be the budget director, pulls her aside and says, you know, you don't have to attend every one of these. You have a luxury as CEA director. You can kind of pick and choose your battles and decide what you want to focus on. And again, it's kind of a revelatory moment for her because she just doesn't realize how this works. So, you're absolutely right. There are pitfalls to being a complete novice when it comes to this, in the same way that there are pitfalls. I mean, they're different pitfalls, but they certainly exist when you're experienced. And I think, you know, to the extent that I have a critique of Obama and the way he staffed his administration, it's the proportions were out of whack. You clearly can't have an administration, particularly dealing with an economic crisis, entirely staffed with Christina Romers. But having too many of the Larry Summers and Tim Geithners in there led to some of these other problems that we can talk about, or I can talk about right now. And so I think the proportions were a little off. They just skewed too much toward the veterans who'd done this before, and there was not enough new blood. And as a result, I think they created some real problems for themselves.
Yeah, just one more thing on Christina Romer. The story you tell about, it shows that her, out of her deftness or her lack of preparation, lasted all the way until the end of her tenure, where when she said to some people in a White House meeting, "Oh, I'm thinking of leaving," and she guys, I guess, wanted validation to say,
right,
people to say, "Hey, you should stay," but instead they said, "Okay, let's prepare a press release." And
no, that's exactly
that's
right.
A great story.
This was September of 2010, and she had wanted to basically stay till January because it would have made it 2 years, and they kind of planned accordingly. And so she comes in and says, "You know, I could leave now, or I could leave in January." You know, and they say essentially, "Great. Well, why don't we plan on having you leave now then?" You're absolutely right. It every tactical decision that kind of Washington veterans understand how to deal with almost as second nature, she seemed to sort of play the wrong way.
Yeah, and then the cross-pollination of hatreds I found really amazing. So Geithner and Gensler, even though there was some similarities, they
right.
both worked together in, Treasury before, but they didn't like each other at all. And Summers versus Orszag, and then Romer versus Summers.
Right.
And then if you look at the Jody Cantor book, there was Gibbs versus Jarrett.
Right.
You say this White House, can you talk a little bit about these cross-pollinated hatreds? And would you say that this White House is a little more watch your back than your average White House?
Yeah. I every White House has its share of dysfunction. I do think, there was a certain familiarity, I guess, that bred contempt in some respects. And Orszag and Summers in particular were had actually been pretty friendly. I mean, Orszag had been director of the Hamilton Project, this sort of advocacy / research group run out of Brookings that Bob Rubin had founded and bankrolled, basically, or helped, fundraise for. They had worked together. They had, co-written papers when Orszag was the director. But they immediately sensed that they would be rivals. Summers, as part of his deal with Rahm Emanuel, the chief of staff, basically wanted every prerogative that was accorded to the national security advisor to flow to him in the economic sphere. So anything that had remote relevance to economics, he wanted to flow through his office. And of course, the budget is, an economic, a big economic project. And Orszag immediately sensed that Summers was going to try to poach on his terrain and wanted to protect it as much as possible. So this proved to be a huge source of tension from the very beginning. Whenever people from Summers' office would call OMB and try to, solicit information, OMB would get very defensive, to the point where Orszag had his chief of staff, had every aide refer these calls to his chief of staff just so they could keep track of the outflow of information to the NEC. It got to be a very contentious situation. And I think it was just because, partly there were some ideological differences, but really it was two guys who were very bright, who both basically felt like they were capable of running the show. And they sort of acutely felt and were acutely aware of any kind of wandering of the other person into their terrain. And in a way, it was more awkward because they had known each other for so long and they had mutual friends who, in many cases, were working for the other side. You know, people sort of felt like, it's almost like when mom and dad are fighting and you're the child, you almost feel it more acutely because you're suddenly forced to choose a side and you're you're forced to choose between people that you have relationships with. So it got very, very sort of raw as a result of all these cross-cutting relationships that preceded the administration.
You talk a lot about Larry Summers and about his childhood and his upbringing. And there's one thing where you talk about how he thinks if he applies his mind to anything, he can be the best at it, the debate club and stuff like that. And then he plays some guy who's a top chess player. And I wasn't even quite sure what happened in that chess match. You had a quote from the chess player who I guess beat him, who just said he won much of a match. But what happened there?
Yeah, so Summers does have a tendency, you know, he's a brilliant guy, clearly, but does have a tendency to overestimate his own ability, particularly when he's kind of coming fresh into something. You know, there's an area where he's a novice. He thinks he can get up to speed, you know, more quickly than I think he actually can. And so he had this friend in high school, Mark Moskowitz, who went on to become a reasonably successful political consultant, who was a citywide chess champion. And so Summers taught himself the game and was getting good and decided he's going to challenge his friend, the chess champion. And the friend says, you know, Larry, I could beat you blindfolded. You know, really, you're not on my level. And Summers says, you know, there's no way you could beat me blindfolded. Like, I refuse to believe that. And so they play, and Moskowitz is blindfolded, and he just wipes the table clean with Summers.
I didn't catch that he actually did wear the blindfold. It wasn't clear.
Yeah. He won blindfolded, and he gave me this quote afterwards, which is, that is Larry, basically. You know, he sort of comes in guns blazing, and then reality sometimes hits him in the face. And it certainly did in that case. You know, the thread from that to the rest of the narrative in the book is, I think, Summers often overestimated his own tactical and political savvy when it came to navigating Washington. And, you know, the guy clearly has tactical savvy and understands, the way politics intersects with policy, but I think tends to overestimate his understanding of this and probably outsmarted himself a bit a number of times. The time that I focus most on is in the passing of the stimulus, where he kind of factored in tactical political considerations into his recommendation to the president, rather than just presenting the kind of pure economic policy argument. And I think that had some bad consequences.
Yeah. And then you've got Rahm Emanuel, who has got his own share of ego and is all rough elbows. And he's supposed to manage this herd. And you have that one story where Summers starts screaming at him in a profane way about how they can't get the motor pool right, so he can't get a car in time. Right. And he said, can you get me a car? And Emanuel says offhandedly, I'll get you a car, Larry. And Larry screams at him, don't say it if you can't do it. Because Larry knew the White House. He knows that the National Economic Council advisor is not eligible for a car.
That's right. That's right. No, he absolutely knew it. And, this was, it's funny. Someone once told this to me, and I think it's very true. Rahm Emanuel has this reputation as being very gruff and in your face and very conflict loving, you know, kind of seeking out conflict. In fact, it's the opposite. Rahm, and I think this was a real sort of structural problem in the administration. Rahm is actually kind of conflict averse, and he comes on very strong because he's trying to sort of ward it off. You know, it's kind of a protection device almost. He doesn't want to get in these situations where he's got to deal with people and look them in the eye and deal with them head on. So he does this, you know, he comes on gruff to sort of ward them off, hoping he won't have to do it. And I think, that actually had substantive problems, because Rahm would tend to kind of ignore problems and then they would fester. And then, you know, he'd come back to them a couple of months later and it would turn out to be, you know, by that point, very difficult to deal with them. One problem I talked about in the book is financial reform. I think Rahm, to his credit, saw that this was going to be politically very important. You know, you can't shovel hundreds of billions of dollars, in fact, trillions, when you factor in Fed guarantees to banks and other financial institutions. Rahm saw that you would need a credible financial reform plan from the very beginning, because you would need to convince voters that, as terrible as this was, that you had to spend all this money bailing these institutions out, it was not going to happen again. And financial reform was going to be the way that you showed them that it wasn't going to happen again. And Geithner had a completely different view. He felt like you don't do reform in a crisis. It becomes even more destabilizing. You know, the system's already fragile. And here you want to go starting to shift things around and rearrange the way we regulate these institutions. And so Geithner was very savvy in realizing that if you could just kind of kind of straight arm Rom for a little bit, he would lose interest and kind of back down and go off and do something else and maybe come back a couple months later, by which point you could have a conversation about what you were prepared to do. So I do think that, you know, while it seems sort of kind of trivial and maybe gossipy, I do think that actually gets at something, which is Rom really did want to avoid conflict a lot, despite his kind of superficial gruffness. And that that did allow things to fester at times in unhealthy ways.
Yeah, well, Rom is now gone. Obviously, he's mayor of Chicago. And Daley was around for a little while, but didn't get the best reviews. And now Jack Lew is there. And he seems different to me than the other alpha male nerds of the first few years. You know, Orszag, Emanuel, Summers. I mean, he's a very bright Jewish person. But
yeah, right.
He's different is that he doesn't seem to be the same kind of chest beater. Is that would that be a right analysis, you think?
I think so, yeah. He's definitely a more earnest guy, certainly a less Machiavellian guy. It would be very tough to imagine Jack Lew in this kind of endless tit for tat turf battle of the sort that Peter Orszag and Larry Summers engaged in. I think that, you know, actually Lew was the person they originally wanted for the NEC director job, which is the job Summers got, because they thought he would be very good at, you know, dealing with all the other egos and managing the process. And I think they were right. It just turned out that they needed that particular musical chair once they installed Geithner as Treasury Secretary, because there wasn't another high-profile place to stick Larry Summers. So I think their impulses were right. And I think Jack Lew, by all accounts, was less brash, kind of took up less space. And I think, you know, was a guy who, I mean, one of the kind of recurring themes in the book, I mean, I think you see it most with Summers, but it certainly figures into other areas and with other people, is this kind of overthinking of tactical considerations and over applying probably excessive weight to them. And it's ironic because he's now chief of staff, which is a very political position. But I think Lew is someone who's less that way. I mean, he's more earnest and more of a wonk, and by which I don't mean kind of substantively more capable. I mean, these other guys were very capable substantively, but he's more of a kind of substantive purist. And to the extent that he's got sort of tactical notions, they're not about, you know, how you position the president before the country and before the voters, but how you negotiate with appropriators in the House to arrive at this agreement, this budget agreement. So it's a very interesting choice, because it says to me that Obama thinks that, you know, the focus of his second term is really going to be kind of hammering out deals, you know, kind of economic deals, whether it's the budget or tax reform, with Republicans, that will kind of consume, you know, the next 2 years. Because if it was, if you were planning on sort of playing for the voters, you know, broadly speaking, I don't think Jack Lew would be your guy.
You said in there about the second term, it sounds like the Obama White House is already assuming that they're going to have a second term. Do you think, A, do you think that's the assumption? B, do you think with Jack Lew, they found the right guy if that's going to be, if there is going to be a second term? And C, is that what you were getting at with the title, The Escape Artist? They had a lot of dysfunction in the first term, but they managed to make it through and they're going to be in good shape going forward?
Yes, I do. I do think they're planning on a second term at this point. They've been very good this time, and we had sort of a false dawn on the economy in 2010, and then again in 2011. Yes, 2010, then 2011. So I think they played it a little cooler this time. I mean, just now that we've gotten several months of a pretty good job news, I think they're now allowing themselves a little, to claim a little more credit, But I think they've been pretty good about not overplaying it. We don't hear talk of, you know, mission accomplished or anything like that. I think Lew, I'm skeptical that he's the right choice. I mean, I think that, you know, it may be the case that the next year or two is going to be consumed with negotiations on Capitol Hill with Republicans, and that you need a Lew on your team. But I don't know why the right spot for him is in budget director. It seems to me that...
Well, he's been there.
Well, he has been there, but...
Twice, right?
Yeah, yeah. But it seems like, you know, that kind of you know, your chief of staff needs to be a little more ecumenical, I think, and be able to sort of transcend the kind of tactical considerations and try to hit a slightly higher note, or at least kind of enable the president to do that. And I'm not sure that Lou is the right person for that. I mean, you know, there are other reasons that you appoint someone chief of staff. You trust them, you work well with them, you find them to be loyal. And I think Lou is all those things, conscientious. But
Boy Scout.
What's that?
He's a Boy Scout?
He's a Boy Scout, absolute Boy
Scout.
Loyal,
trustworthy, et cetera.
And so I think he dots those eyes. But I think, you know, they need someone who, you know, I think the big mistake of Obama's first few years was to kind of just miss where the country was, really. You know, I mean, there was this huge populist frustration with A, the fact that we shoveled a lot of money at the banks, and B, that unemployment rate was really high. And there just wasn't, I mean, Emmanuel got that, but he was too frenetic and too sort of conflict averse to ultimately kind of execute the right response. I think, you know, you still need someone who gets that, you know, you still need to sort of see where the country is. And there's very little in Lou's background that suggests to me that he is someone with a real finger on the pulse of public opinion. I think that they've been a little too insulated, you know, and not actually thinking through enough the consequences of this really intense public frustration. And I don't think just that's going to go away just by virtue of Obama winning re-election, if that should happen. On the title escape artist, yeah, I mean, the idea was a variety of things. I mean, was just these were people who, you know, who were skilled in rescuing sort of both presidents and economies from really dicey situations. And it's a little bit ironic, you know, the idea is to suggest that while they were the people that you might be inclined to turn to, they brought some baggage with them too. You know, it was there was a little bit of a best and the brightest style irony there. You know, look, I mean, I think I say it in the epilogue of the book. There's no question that they escaped the fate that was, you know, the worst fate, which would have been a depression. I mean, we now know that the economy was shrinking at an annual rate of 9% in the fourth quarter of 2008. That's a depression sized number, you know, particularly if you allow it to sort of snowball. So they clearly helped avoid the worst. And in that sense, you know, maybe Obama wasn't wrong to tap these group of people who had some sort of track record on that front. But it's meant to be, you know, it's meant to be, I guess, semi-ironic. There was a reason that you would think of them this way, but Obama probably was overconfident by the extent to which they were very deft at executing this sort of escape.
You mentioned a couple of minutes ago about the negotiations with the Hill and how that's going to be really important in the next, let's say it's just a year or maybe 5 years. And there was one section where you talked about how Eric Cantor and John Kyle, the senator from Arizona, were negotiating with Jack Lew, I guess when he was still at OMB, and Gene Sperling at NEC. And you have Kyle saying to them somewhat incredulously, and I'm quoting here, "There are Medicare savings that you think would be good policy, but you won't do them unless we agree to more taxes." And then Lou and Sperling say yes. I mean, is that the approach of the Obama White House, that they want to raise taxes so much, or they want to make the Republicans raise taxes so much that they're willing to overlook good policy?
Yeah, look, I mean, for them, they think two things. One is a substantive point, and the other is political. The substantive point is they don't think just cuts. You can get there. You can't get, they think that revenues that are at a historically low place, and they don't think you can get to sort of a long-term stable, you know, balance without raising revenue. So there's that point. Now, you could argue, well, sure, but you should just do the cuts you can do and pocket those, and then we'll talk about revenue down the line. And that's where the more political point comes in, which is they just think this is about, you know, Obama said it before, it's about shared sacrifice, and there's no way that you can ask seniors who are by and large, you know, the seniors who would be affected by these cuts you know, disproportionately, who are by and large, you know, not affluent, to bear the brunt of them without some kind of reciprocity from the affluent on the revenue side. So so it's both a substantive and political point, but I think the political point, you know, I did kind of make it with a lowercase p rather than a capital P. It was more, by political, I mean just a almost a shared sense of fairness rather than, or a sense of shared fairness, shared sacrifice rather than something that, you know, they felt like they were going to appeal to this or that particular constituency by you know, holding the line on that. It really was, you know, I describe another scene in the book where these negotiators come back to Obama and they're sort of, they don't yet, and they turn out to be wrong, they don't yet know they're going to get this deal, but they describe, you know, if things continue along this trajectory in their negotiations with Cantor and Kyle, maybe they'll be able to get some kind of deal where they close these, they eliminate these tax breaks for oil and gas companies in exchange for doing something on Medicare. And Obama kind of looks at them and says, you know, that's it, you know, that's all you got for me. And basically says, you know, if that's all we're doing, that doesn't seem fair to me. Go back and get more sacrifice from the wealthy here. So, so, you know, I and that was kind of a reflex on Obama's part. That wasn't after like looking over polling data and deciding like, oh, this is going to kill us among this particular constituency if we go this route. But I do think it was political, and I mean that in kind of the broadest sense of the word, in the sense of kind of what your values are and what your priorities are.
Well, one other thing that jumped out at me in that particular section is you're talking about Eric Cantor, who has been criticized a lot from the left and especially sort of official Democratic policy to criticize him. But you called him serious, pragmatic, and strikingly well-prepared.
Yeah,
I think that kind of doesn't jibe with the public perception, or at least the Democrats' attempted public perception of him.
I think so. Yeah, I mean, Eric Cantor turned out to be a very interesting character for these guys to deal with. I mean, they definitely felt, you know, from his public persona, that they were going to hate him. You know, and I think Obama doesn't like him. You know, there's something clearly between Obama and Cantor. But the guys who were in the negotiating room, the Gene Sperlings, the Tim Geithners, the Jack Lews, were very impressed by him. Not ideologically. I mean, they were still far apart ideologically, but they very much, you know, felt like he was a guy you could engage with on a policy level. Whereas Boehner, you know, dealt with things at such a high level of abstraction and was so removed from details that it was kind of worthless to have private conversations with him. You know, he'd had to check with aides and with lieutenants like Cantor, you know, for everything that had any kind of policy consequence. Cantor knew his stuff. He was well informed. He could talk details. And, you know, in a way, I think it was almost dangerous for these guys. They found that very seductive. It reminded them of negotiations with Republicans in the 90s, where a guy like John Kasich got in the room and seemed very different than his public persona. And so they thought, oh, well, you know, John Kasich proved to be a guy we could do business with in the 90s. You know, once we got in the room with him, we thought he was different. And then they get in the room with Cantor and they see that he's a bit different in that he's so well prepared and so facile with this stuff. And I think that led them astray, because as knowledgeable as Cantor was and as able as he was and fluent with policy, he still wasn't going to budge on anything, you know, because he had these constraints that he was operating under, which was that his caucus wasn't going to go for revenue hikes. It just wasn't going to do it. So I think the Cantor persona that they found in private actually ended up kind of leading them astray. They thought they could do more business with him than they actually could.
I have one more question for you before we get to our final wrap-up question. I really, as you can tell, I read the book carefully. And I also read the footnotes, because you had so many great juicy tidbits in there. And so many of the best and the juiciest tidbits were from that dreaded phrase, anonymous interviews with the author. What's your thoughts on this approach on, you know, Bob Woodward obviously does similar things.
Sure.
And are these names going to be public someday, 75 years in the future or something like that? Will you write something in your will about it?
Right. It's a very fair question. You know, I tried to be as transparent as possible. I mean, Woodward doesn't really ever include footnotes. You know, so I tried to give you the date and some description of the person at least. And, you know, beyond that, I did go to people and try to get them on the record, you know, so you'll notice you know, there's some, you know, Peter Orszag on the record quotes and Christy Romer and Larry Summers has one, and there's some Geithner quotes. So I did, whenever possible, try to get these guys on the record. I mean, just, you know, the unfortunate fact of Washington and doing these books is people are anxious, you know, about talking to you, and particularly being candid. So it was not surprising. You try to put in place several safeguards against people just spinning you, you know, under the cover of anonymity. You know, one of the things I found very helpful was, you know, don't just rely on the White House to, you know, if there's a part of the story that you're telling where they interact with someone else, whether it's another regulator or, you know, people on Capitol Hill, talk to those people too, you know, and compare notes so that people just aren't BSing you under the cover of anonymity. So, you know, you try to nail stuff down the best you can and cross check and double and triple check. And then, you know, again, where possible, you try to get people on the record. The bottom line is these books couldn't be written without, you know, granting that cover to sources. And, posthumously, the agreement with the source, you know, probably is good for their lifetime. So I think I would feel comfortable if people are still interested in 50 years, you know, revealing names. But I felt like basically the level of transparency I provided probably went beyond the typical, you know, Susskind or Woodward account. And I tried to push it as far as I could.
Well, I'll follow up on you in about 50 years on that.
Okay, but, I look forward to that, yes.
So the last question is our signature question here on New Books in Public Policy, which is, if you were czar for a day, what would you do? What public policy proposals would you put in place to solve some of the crises we face today?
I think the biggest thing I do, you know, I've heard there's been sort of discussion about this recently. I think it would be a carbon tax. And I would, you know, this got a lot of buzz, I think, a couple of years ago. I think some of my colleagues have talked about it, too, more recently. But, you know, I think you impose a carbon tax and then lower payroll tax to make it wash out for workers who would be hit disproportionately hard by that. I mean, I'm fanatically anxious about global warming. I really do think it's an existential crisis, and it's one that we're incredibly late in getting to. As someone with some economics background, the logic of this is just, it's unassailable. I mean, there's this huge externality on carbon that that no one factors in when they purchase it or produce it or produce energy, of which carbon is a byproduct. So that, to me, that's the no-brainer. You know, I would do that on, you know, in the same way that Mitt Romney would repeal Obamacare on day one, I would impose a carbon tax on day one if it were up to me.
Well, there you have it. Noam Scheiber, thanks for joining us on New Books in Public Policy.
Hey, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
I hope you've enjoyed this podcast with Noam Scheiber, author of The Escape Artist. As you can tell from the podcast, there are a number of very strong personalities inside the Obama White House, and especially on the Obama economic team. They don't always get along, and their internal struggles are not always to the benefit of the country. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed the podcast. I hope you continue to listen in the future. And as always, my recommendation to you is to keep reading.